2018.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Turner Project book release on Thursday, May 24th at 6:30 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The Matt Turner Project allows artists of color to go beyond the usual initial expositions inherent in presenting art born of marginalized perspectives to a dominant culture and creates an environment of inclusivity, a communal harbor for artists previously silenced by institutional constraints, and actively provides priority spaces to artists of color. Their first catalog, titled Matt Turner Project Testimony, will be released and celebrated with food, drink, and music. Again, that's the Matt Turner Project book release on Thursday, May 24th at 6:30 p.m. at City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the artist and poet Jen Bervin. Jen Bervin's work often involves a combination of text and textile, weaving together art, writing, science, and archival research into one of the most unique bodies of work in contemporary writing or visual art today. She's the author of 10 books, books that include one of the canonical texts of erasure poetry, Nets, an engagement with Shakespeare's sonnets published by Ugly Duckling Press, and of which Paul Auster says, Jen Bervin's Nets has reimagined Shakespeare as our true contemporary. Her other books include The Gorgeous Nothings, Emily Dickinson's Envelope Poems, co-edited with Marta Werner, out from New Directions. The Gorgeous Nothings was named a Best Book of the Year by The New Yorker and the Times Literary Supplement, was a finalist for the Poetry Foundation's 2014 Pegasus Award for Criticism, and by foregrounding the visual art component of Dickinson's poetry, has played a crucial role in our ongoing reevaluation of Emily Dickinson's writing on its own terms. As Ben Lerner said in The New Yorker, this exquisitely produced book, lovingly curated by Bervin and Werner, allows you to encounter Emily Dickinson's envelope poems in full color facsimile for the first time. It's an experience suspended between reading and looking, of toggling between those two modes of perception, and it thoroughly refreshes both. Jen Bervin's large-scale art installations include River, a project 10 years in the making of a hand-sewn geocentric model of the Mississippi River in silver sequins, as well as the Dickinson Composite Series, a series of large-scale embroideries that, as an act of mending and restitution, depicts with cotton and silk thread the variant words and variant marks that we've come to realize are so vital to Dickinson's poetics, but which were regularly omitted along with her preferred line breaks in the reading editions of her poems. Jen Bervin's work has been exhibited nationally and internationally and is held in more than 30 collections, including those of Yale and Stanford Universities, the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and the J. Paul Getty Museum. Bervin is the recipient of many awards and honors, including an Asian Cultural Council Fellowship, the Rauschenberg Residency, the Fit Artist in Residence at Brown University, and a Creative Capital Grant. And she's here today to talk about Silk Poems, which debuted as an exhibition at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art in 2016, and which was released as a book of poetry from Nightboat Books in 2017. In which Publishers Weekly calls one of her finest achievements to date. Terrence Hayes says this of Silk Poems. Read Jen Bervin's fascinating Silk Poems 100 times, and you will be given 100 gifts. This sensational book addresses both the past and the future, art and science, the earth and the stars. Everywhere Silk Poems is in incomparable conversation with us. And Mary Ruffel adds, Jen Bervin's work, all of it, engages the eye, the hand, the ear, and the mind. Her artistry is vast and inclusive by finesse and intelligence, by curiosity, forbearance, and vision. She knows the unexpected wonder of pattern is everywhere, and that the smallest detail contains enough energy to spawn a universe. I think they should send her into space. if it were not for the fact her work has already sent us there. Her poems in themselves, those exhilarated fragments, are the purest form of the art itself. They contain the innate inner gradients of whatever takes our breath away. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jen Bourbon.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. I would love to just start with the incredible origin story. Maybe we can, it feels like it really informs the reading of the book to sort of know how you came to it. So maybe we can start with how this became a project for you and then how it evolved into what we have now.
Well, it became a project very casually. I would say it wasn't a project to begin with. It was just a question about what was happening at the Tufts University lab. Theo Amanetto and David Kaplan were working with liquefied silk, and what interested me about it was its biocompatibility. Silk is 100% biocompatible with our bodies. Any place in the body, it can be used optically. It can be nano-patterned. The instance that I was excited about when I visited the lab, I mean, they were working on a huge range of things and continue to, but the instance that really struck me was a nano-patterned optical silk biosensor, so made from liquefied silk, and they were developing it as something you could implant under the skin.
So by biocompatible, you mean that our bodies aren't going to reject it,
exactly,
no matter where it's put.
Exactly.
But tell us a little bit what a biosensor is, and then perhaps you can also just explain what nanopatterning is also, so that people know why that would be intriguing to you as a writer.
Absolutely. So biosensors, I guess one of the sort of most recognizable form of a biosensor.
About Silk Poems, which debuted as an exhibition at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art in 2000. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jen Bourbon.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. I would love to just start with the incredible origin story. Maybe we can, it feels like it really informs the reading of the book to sort of know how you came to it. So maybe we can start with how this became a project for you and then how it evolved into what we have now.
Well, it became a project very casually. I would say it wasn't a project to begin with. It was just a question about what was happening at the Tufts University lab. Theo Amanetto and David Kaplan were working with liquefied silk, and what interested me about it was its biocompatibility. Silk is 100% biocompatible with our bodies. Any place in the body, it can be used optically. It can be nano-patterned. The instance that I was excited about when I visited the lab, I mean, they were working on a huge range of things and continue to, but the instance that really struck me was a nano-patterned optical silk biosensor, so made from liquefied silk, and they were developing it as something you could implant under the skin.
So by biocompatible, you mean that our bodies aren't going to reject it,
exactly,
no matter where it's put.
Exactly.
But tell us a little bit what a biosensor is, and then perhaps you can also just explain what nanopatterning is also, so that people know why that would be intriguing to you as a writer.
Absolutely. So biosensors, I guess one of the sort of most recognizable form of a biosensor today would be like a Fitbit or something that's reading on the body and communicating technologically. The kind of biosensors that I encountered at Tufts were very, I mean, I want to say they're very simple, they weren't, but it was a nano-pattern surface. So this is very, very small-scale patterning, like something you'd see on the surface of a butterfly wing. You know, the way that nano-patterning was explained to me by Theo Amanetto was a blue butterfly wing that looks blue, but structural blue and not pigmented blue, is a result of nano patterning on the surface. And if you were to drop a little bit of acetone on the wing of that blue butterfly, it would go clear in that place until the acetone dried. And in that way, the nano pattern surface makes it a sensor for acetone. So it reads acetone on the surface.
Okay.
The biosensor, the silk biosensor, works in a similar way. It's made from liquefied silk nano pattern.
And how did you make the leap conceptually or inspirationally from nano patterning to poetry? Like, how did that occur to you in the process of going there with this open question about silk in this new medical arena?
Well, it came from the context of the sensor. So when I saw the prototype in Theo's office, it's because of the way it's patterned, you can project through it with fiber optic light and actually read an image with light on the wall. So I could see what was on the sensor, not with the naked eye, but by projecting it. And I saw the Tufts logo and various forms of clip art, and I thought, well,
as a
proof of concept, it's perfectly reasonable. But when I was thinking about what that sensor was being developed to do, which was to go under the skin and be a kind of a visual monitor through the skin for blood levels or blood sugar or something that would be read daily,
It really gave me
pause. I thought that's a really significant reading space. It's a significant space of imagination.
And a person who's monitoring their health that closely needs a lot of things aside from just monitoring.
And I think that's the sort of thing that poetry and art can respond to very agilely and in a very interdisciplinary fluid way.
So the idea
to write the poem in the biosensor really came from
wanting to insert
a form of care and a depth of attention to material, to cultural context of silk and health.
I love that the poem is addressed to the person who has the poem inside of them, and that the speaker of the poem is the silkworm. I think that is so beautiful, and I just wanted to ask you about if you felt like the silkworm had particular insights around mortality.
Massive insights. I mean, silkworm's life cycles are pretty short. You know, 30 days, roughly. And within that life cycle, they go through a lot of transformation. Dive instars or cycles of
gorging themselves
on leaves,
pause
or diapause, which I refer to as sleep sometimes in the poem.
And then they wake up, they shed their last skin,
and their new skin looks different each time. So it's their rate of transformation is really astounding. And I felt like within their life cycle, they understand a lot of living and dying, and then they live and die a lot. And it's a culture that's been going 5,000 years.
I started to think about the silkworm life cycle
as 5,000 years rather than the 30 day.
If we think of the voice of the poem coming from the silkworm with this unique insight into mortality, it seems like, at least historically, you mentioned that the earliest function of silk fabrics was wrapping children's bodies in tubes. And then I was just having a conversation with Forrest Gander and preparing for that conversation. One of his books talks about how Mexico, if a child dies, they put silk over his face. Believing that worms will recognize themselves and not and eat their face. But this connection to death seems like something that we've recognized. Around silk. Does that seem right?
That it's not just imagining
the silkworm perspective, but somehow we have connected silk in a way to the funereal rite in some fashion, historically.
Perfectly astute, as always.
I want, if we were to take that step further, What are your thoughts on poetry with regards to that? I mean, on the one hand, it feels like people always lament it as a marginal art, and then on the other hand, it feels like even people who maybe are scared of poetry crave it to mark various important moments of their life. Do you feel like there's some sort of resonance between putting a poem in, spoken by a silkworm, versus a personal essay?
Well, I think you're exactly right. They are essential, and we realize how essential they are when life and while living and dying gets to the space of the essential. So when someone's very ill, or when we have a really deep cultural moment that needs to be addressed, people always look to poems. They're always seeking them out. Someone gets married, someone is born, someone dies.
Yeah, so it's not just death, but it somehow is marking the passing of time in some way.
Absolutely, or the important occasions in our lives, or the sort of unspeakable occasions in our lives when we're just deeply lonely.
That's what I wonder, if it is something about the unspeakable, because language sort of might fail in capturing those moments, but poetry sort of allows the failure, the unspeakability, in a way that may be a narrative.
Absolutely, I feel like it's at the edge of that.
Yeah. And is the Silk Poems Project in conversation with any history of poems in or on the body? Is there a tradition around that of, I wonder, pre-medically, if there's implanted, if there's any sort of implantedness of things or hidden poems in the history of
I mean, not necessarily poetry per se, but definitely the West African talisman. And that art influenced how I thought about silk poems, this sort of secret text on the body, and even in form, in some ways, the sort of the deeply crenellated folds of a talismanic text hid inside of an object. They mirror the kind of folding in the beta sheet of the silk DNA. So I started to think about those in relation to each other.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we were talking today to Jen Bourbon about her latest book from Nightboats Books, Silk Poems. And if we think of this as a talisman, so this person who's ill is receiving a biosensor, which is hopefully going to monitor their health, but also receiving this poem that's written by a silkworm who's imparting wisdom to them. It's a layer of protection. You've mentioned it as a carrier of our cultural history, you mentioned at the beginning here. So it's a tiny sensor, and you've also pointed out at the same time the silk road spanned a quarter of the equator. So can you talk to us a little bit about some of that cultural history that you hope is imbuing this talisman with a certain power that isn't simply the medical power?
Absolutely. I think that space of monitoring can be a very lonely or anxious space, and I think there's something unique to silk that it's so international. It has such longevity, and it places in that context a sense of a witness. You know, that there's this very deep, very old, extremely nuanced history and culture that goes with this material, that accompanies this little tiny sensor under the skin. And
that's all the material, which is so simple,
it's just protein and water, is a carrier for that culture. So I wanted the poem to share some of that.
Because Sarah Culture starts in China,
I wanted the bulk of the center of gravity of the cultural aspect of the poem to really stay there, read there, speak there. And think there. So,
before I sort of engaged with this project, of course I thought of China. I think a lot of people would think of China. But the more that I looked at what you did, the more you really realize how much of it is outside of China also. Can you speak to some of the other influences or other places that you went? Like, I discovered, for instance, in watching some of the videos that the Caucasus Mountains were the site of making silk for most of Europe. So even though China, I think of it as the source, it's the source in China, but not necessarily in other places.
Right. Everyone learns sericulture from China. But I think now the largest producers of silk are India, Brazil, and China. I visited seven countries, 30 different sites. Turkey, Georgia, in the Middle East, Italy and France in Europe, China, Japan, and then it's the various sites throughout the U.S.
And when you say sites, we're talking a wide variety of types of places. So what would be like the two ends of that? So one, I'm guessing, would be places where silk is farmed, sericulture sites.
Right.
And then what would be something that would seem really different than that?
I would start in places where I've researched before, like the Rati Textile Library at the Metropolitan Museum. Was a really good logical first place to start because Rati was founded in Como, in Lake Como in Italy, which was a site for silk, primarily printing at this point. But I also needed to know how things like nanopatterning come to be, and so I visit the Stanford nanofabrication facility just to learn, to get up to speed. And then a lot of silk museums in China and Japan. They're so obvious if you grew up in those cultures, but as a person visiting from Brooklyn, I'd get questions like, "Don't you have silk museums in the U.S?"
It's interesting.
I think for especially, a lot of people I've talked to raise silkworms, as a class project, like the same way that, as a kid growing up in Iowa, we plant a pea seed in a milk carton. And it was just a thing that everyone did as part of their elementary school education. So most people have a very clear memory. Of that process.
So not only does the poem come from the voice of the silkworm, but you mentioned this briefly about the beta sheet, which I'd like to lean into a little bit. You said that the silk, the properties of silk, or you wanted silk in its essence to inform the structure of the poem. So tell us the ways in which silk informs the structure of silk poems. And part of that might be just unpacking for us what some of the terminology is around the ways you've seen these microscopic, macroscopic resonances.
I'd love to. So at the DNA level, the building block of silk is just protein and water. Silk has two parts to it, the fibroin and the sericin. And when it's made in the body of a silkworm, it's coming out of the silkworm glands. So two little glands with fibroin are coming from either side of the body, and then in their spinneret, they combine with sericin, which is kind of like a gummy glue coating. And sericin is used in things like fish flakes or fish food flakes. So you find it in things you might have touched or seen in your life. And fibroin is usually separated out, or at least it is at Tufts, in this reverse engineered state. So going back to the gland of the little silkworm. And I didn't know how I was going to write the poem. I didn't know what it would contain. I knew what I wanted to think about or ask or go in search of. But, I knew almost nothing about what I would do before I did it. So I was really looking seriously to try to figure these things out. So the DNA... self-structures as a beta sheet, and that looks a lot like a weft thread in a weaving. It snakes back and forth, or it can be likened to a form of writing called the bostrophedon, where you have alternating lines going left to right, right to left, in elegiac couplets in ancient Greece, when Greek and Phoenician were kind of mashing up as languages. Originally, when I first started, I thought I wanted to do something with Ostrephodons that had this relationship to the beta sheep. And then I got a little further into the research and realized that the silkworm, when it writes its cocoon, is using this snaking back and forth pattern, sort of like infinity-like looping drawing, and that all silkworms do that. And so you have this sort of collapse of scale between the tiny, tiny DNA beta sheet scale, the filament scale, and then the piece that I didn't really have until almost the exact window where I started writing the poem is that line, what I'd been imagining as a single line, was actually collapsing down to a strand of a six-letter enjambed column of text. So that six-letter enjambed part comes from the genome sequence. There's a six-letter repeat in the genome that makes it very stable. And so I imagine the poem as a kind of a column, and then that column extruded out into this snaking silkworm filament shape. And I think that really came from an experience I had in Turkey at the Topkapi Palace of looking at Islamic manuscripts. And you know, when you look at the image of the manuscript, you have this collapse of scale from something that looks like a letter that's made of lots and lots and lots of letters, you know, or something like a decorative border that's made up of finer and finer language. So, I'm sorry to be going in all sorts of different directions, but that, I feel like that's the kind of thinking that I needed
to use in making the poem.
Yeah, and when you look at the pattern on the biosensor, it looks like the movements on the cocoon of the movement of the silkworm.
Yeah.
And you might not know unless you can magnify enough that that thread you're seeing is actually the six-letter columnar poem itself. I love that.
When it was on view at Mass MoCA, you could read the poem through the microscope. So you could move the stage of the microscope around on the XY axis and read various points of the poem. So you could see letters. You could read. It's kind of hard to read in a six-letter and jammed strand with no spaces. So you don't know where the words break and where the lines break. So I want to go
a little further into this mirroring of the microscopic and macroscopic, the small and the large, because I see this in your other projects too, like perhaps most obviously the river, which is in a fixed relationship to the Mississippi River, and 1 inch of your river corresponds to 1 mile of the Mississippi River, and also that it took the same amount of time to sow each section of the river as it would to walk that section of the river. And you've talked about the river as the spine of the country, like the spine of a book. So we get all of the small and large, much like we do with the DNA, mimicking, weaving, mimicking the movement of the silkworm. And it made me think of ideas that I think are shared in Western esoteric traditions and in Chinese mythology, as above, so below, or as in heaven, so on earth. And for instance, I think like in Chinese acupuncture, a lot of the points have the same names as stars. And so if you were like doing pre-Maoist acupuncture, if you're doing it from the shamanic tradition, you would be seeing yourself regulating the celestial on the human body as a, sort of like the map of the sky is the human also. So I guess I was just wondering what is attracting you to that relationship to scale that we see reoccur in your work?
That's such a beautiful reading of it. I don't know. I just love that zooming in and zooming out and just how it makes the mind flex. To do so. I recently had the opportunity at Northwestern to look at one of the sequins from the river in an electron microscope, so a SEM microscope, and it was this really wonderful experience of getting to see, you know, this little tiny object, a single sequin that I've been sowing millions of, you know, for, I guess 12 years now total. At that scale, they look like little volcanoes, you know, they look geological.
And also,
in some ways, it got at the fundamental mystery of, you know, what is this object? What is it made of? I don't know anything about this particular